Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 3, Three Approaches to Man, originally delivered on December 4th, 1958.
Will you be so kind and just, open up this guide, chapter 1, the last paragraph. We'll refer to it pretty soon. Chapter 1, the last paragraph. It's page 14. Page 14, last paragraph, is man's distinction consists in a property. It's 14, page 14, last paragraph, chapter 1, where it discusses the concept of Tzelem, of the image of God. Man was created in the image of God. Can I start now? It's quarter past nine. I have asked for the participants, for Dr. Feldman, to submit to me any problem with which, they are concerned with regard to social service, and I'll try to weave, this problem into my lectures. I cannot discuss problems separately because this would be no philosophical presentation, but just a sermon, not out to preach here, give a philosophical sermon. So, in the course of the lectures, I'll take up problems of social service, but don't expect me, to deal with them exclusively. I cannot do that. I'm not a social worker, and to present problems, isolated problems would not serve the purpose. You wouldn't get a picture of Jewish thought with regard to man. Now, what we are going to discuss, today and next lecture and the following lectures, is the concept of the personality in Jewish thought. This would be the last two lectures we devoted to the problem of methodology, how to approach. I'll follow my method of trying to integrate the Jewish idea into the general occidental philosophy of man. Should we inquire of a modern historian of philosophy or of any educated person well acquainted with the history of ideas, what he understands by the word man? If he says man, what does he understand by it? He would immediately advise us about the basic controversy concerning the destiny and essence of this strange being. By the sheer force of associative thinking, he would at once refer to three disparate anthropological philosophical viewpoints. First, the biblical, and by that modern man understands the Judeo-Christian tradition, because actually the fathers of the Christian church adopted the biblical interpretation of man. Of course, they gave it their own slant, so to say, but basically in its fundamentals, the Christian interpretation of man is biblical. The classical Greek-Roman approach to man, and of course, the modern empirical-scientific approach to man. Pressed for further elucidation, if this historian should be pressed, for further elucidation of his cryptic statement and the clear formulation of these irreconcilable concepts of man, to which he referred, he would explain his reference in the following manner. Of course, he would say, the three anthropologists differ in their basic interpretation and evaluation of man. And any attempt, therefore, to merge either all or at least two of them into a single philosophical doctrine of man would be an idle gesture. However, he would continue to explain to us the discrepancy between the concepts of men dating back to antiquity, it means the biblical and the classical Greek, is by far not as wide as the gap separating these two doctrines, means the classical and the biblical, from the empirical scientific one. There is a wide gap separating the classical Greek and the Judaic Christian from the empirical scientific one. As a matter of fact, he would say we may speak of some degree of affinity and even commensurability between the biblical and the classical anthropologists. While the both traditions, the classical and the biblical, are simply incommensurate with the empirical scientific. I'm trying to quote. I mean, an imaginary, we should approach an imaginary historian, I mean, a philosophy, how he would react, respond to such a problem. Both, he would say, are united, the classical and the biblical, in opposition to the scientific approach to man. They, the biblical and the classical traditions, set men apart from other forms of organic life. And here's the main discrepancy. Both the Greeks and the Jews set men apart from other forms of organic life. The world of man, the classical and the biblical tradition would say, these anthropologists maintain, is incongruous with that of the animal and plant. Notwithstanding the fact that all three groups, it means man, animal, and plant, all three groups of organic life are governed alike by kindred, rigid, natural processes and structural developmental patterns, man constitutes a separate entity as a strange being who encounters the kingdom of nature, of which he is physically an integral part. He encounters this kingdom in full awareness of his uniqueness and surveys it boldly from a distance. Man can, so to say, turn around, encounter or face nature as a stranger, as an outsider, while the animal or the plant can do it. I can turn around, not march with nature, just in one direction, but suddenly stop, emerge from my immediacy, and unbroken life functions, turn around and look at nature, not as a natural being, as an outsider, as a judge, as an arbiter, as someone who intervenes in nature from the outside. Man is finite, of course, corporeal, of course, yet different. He is not a particular kind of animal, but is something else. This is basic in both, in the classical and biblical tradition. The empirical scientific tradition, it's a man is an animal, intelligent animal, with more aptitudes, with more capabilities, and with certain skills which the animal doesn't possess, or at least, the skills were more developed by man. But he's a peculiar kind of animal. While the Greeks and the Jews will say, man is not an animal. Man encounters the animal, the plant, as a separate, different, unique being. This is a basic difference. And I want you to understand, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, it has nothing to do with the theory of evolution. We may accept the theory of evolution and say that man is different. And we may reject the theory of evolution and accept, the philosophical viewpoint of our of the positivistic scientific viewpoint that man is a peculiar kind of animal. How man emerged, whether through a process of evolution out of the ape and lower forms of organic life, or emerged in a peculiar manner unknown to us, is not important. This is not a problem. It's not a problem, evolution versus creation. That's what I want to impress upon your mind. It's not the controversy of evolution versus creation. The Greeks didn't believe in creation either. But it's a problem, it's more a, I would say, philosophical problem. What is the essence of man? Is he a very intelligent animal, or is something different? That's how his emergence took place, whether through evolution from the lower forms of organic life, or there was a separate or independent emergence of man, this has nothing to do with our problem. So a Jew can accept evolution, but still say, I'm not discussing now the problem of evolution from a religious viewpoint, but a Jew can accept evolution and still say man is different, regardless how he emerged into the, so to say, arena. He can also reject evolution and say that man is a peculiar kind of animal. He is rather man, a singular being. However, our narrator would say, while the prophetic, or I mean the biblical, and classical doctrines stress the autonomy of man, his unlikeness to and alienation from the world of nature, this was important. He's an alien in the world of nature. They disagree as to the distinctive element in man that enables him to free himself from his naturalness and instinctive immediacy. They would say that the prophetic and classical doctrine say that man is distinct. What do you say? By what is he distinct? What makes him distinct? What is the criterion of distinction by which we judge man separately when you place him in a different dimension of existence, a different existential dimension? He would say, as to that, what is the element which makes man distinct? The Greek and the biblical tradition disagree. They agree that man is distinct, but however, what makes him distinct? What sets him apart from the kingdom of nature? What lends to him autonomy, uniqueness, and singularity? He would say, as far as this is concerned, the Greek, the classical, and the biblical traditions part company and pursue their own philosophies. There is agreement in the basic question whether man is a distinct creature. There is disagreement as to what makes man distinct and singular. The Jewish and Greek schools of thought would suggest two different answers to this question. If we should formulate the question, not what is man. We already asked this question, what is man? And the answer that man is different from any other natural being. I don't mean as far as his body is concerned, as a personality. The other question, what bestows upon men the dignity of being distinct? What gives him autonomy and uniqueness and a separate status incommensurable with that of the animal and plant? So they will give different answers. As a matter of fact, while parting company and disagreeing with respect to the problem of man as a unique being, the Greek tradition, in one respect, dovetails with the positivistic philosophy of man, with the scientific philosophy. Now let us see. We'll come later to this problem, what makes man distinct. But I want to refer to something else, to some other aspect about which, again, the classical and the biblical traditions agree. Classical and biblical traditions also agree on another problem. They both say man's autonomy is something which was given to man not as a grant, as a finished product, or a factum, and all man has to do is to stretch out his hand and take possession of it. But man's autonomy, man's distinctness, was given to man not as a factum, not as a datum, but as an ideal or a task. He can achieve it if he wants it. However, if he doesn't want it, he'll remain part and parcel of brute, insensate, and meaningless nature. Man is provided with an opportunity, both the Greeks and the Jews. It's remarkable sometimes how the Platonic philosophers or the Stoics have simply employed the language which was used by Jewish scholars. And I doubt very much whether they knew of the existence of each other. Certainly not. The Jewish scholars, the Platonic Greek scholars were a world apart. And still it is the same vernacular which both use. The Greek scholars, particularly the Stoic philosophers, and the Talmudic Midrashic scholars. They say man is provided with an opportunity. That's all. To establish his independence. It is not a datum. Which man, reminiscent of the parasitic plant, reminiscent of the parasitic plant, which receives its food, from another plant, has to avail himself. But his distinctness is a creation of his own. It's his own creation. He can create his distinctness. He can remain in anonymity, in natural anonymity. It is not a datum, yes. He is not presented with a gift. The uniqueness of man manifests itself in a challenge, beckoning to and captivating, fascinating this strange being. And sometimes also tantalizing him. He tries to become distinct. He does not succeed. He fails in his effort. It's a tantalizing experience many times. And sometimes a frustrating experience. But nothing else but an ideal, a vision. Rather than a ready-made transcendental endowment to be accepted. It is, if I should use the language of Aristotle, a hue. It means potentiality. It's a potential endowment to be realized and concretized by man, but not an actuality. The Greek philosophy and our tradition speak of man in terms of biological facticity. He's a biological being. And also in categories of a higher life, dedicated to an ultimate goal, an existence in which the otherness and uniqueness of man is fully expressed. The classical schools brought to them the higher life is not given to him. He's got to conquer it by hard work and by dedicating his whole being to one idea, to become different. This is the duty, both in Greek philosophy and in Jewish tradition. Men should be different from the animals. And perhaps if you'll ask me, what is halakhic Judaism? But what is the ultimate end of halakhic Judaism? I would say the duty, the part of man, to be different. Or I would say different, perhaps, is not the proper description, to be unique, to be singular, to be independent of nature. Or if you want to use, to be free. Because if one is unique, he is free. If he lives a life of conformity, he cannot be free. So he's not unique. The classical schools dealt with the problem of the nous. They thought that the element of distinction expressed itself in man's rational capability or in his intellectual capacity. And they spoke about nous poieticos, And nous patheticus, I mean, man is given, is not given an active intellect, they used to say. My mind is now that if you read the guide, he's not given an active intellect. He's given a potential intellect, a nous patheticus, a suffering intellect. It's up to him whether to convert the nous patheticus, it means the potential personality, into a nous patheticus, into an active intellect. It's up to him. This is his job. This is his task. That's what he, why he came into this world for. I mean, why he came into this world. The active and the passive intellects. Man equals either the dwellers of the Olympus, according to the Greek philosophy, or an animal in the woods, in the forest. He can remain imprisoned within the natural realm like any other creature. This doctrine of dualism attained its most succinct formulation in the Stoa. The Stoa actually, I mean, meant to the Stoa was almost deified. The philosopher, the scholar, was the ideal type. But the philosopher, of the, this was the extreme ideal type of the spiritual personality. On the other hand, the Stoics knew of brute man. Brute man means a man who did not actualize his potentialities. The philosopher means a man who attained the utmost as far as actualization and concretization of his own personality are concerned. Judaism also treats man as a biological entity. If there is a religion which was conscious and aware that man is a biological being, what is Judaism? Because man is called in Judaism either Adam means made out, merged out of the earth, or Basa, flesh. Treats man as a biological entity on the one hand, and as a spiritual being on the other hand. The discrepancy of man. But while the biological entity is created, given, it's a datum, it's a fact, the spiritual personality is an idea. He can attain it, but if he refuses, he's too lazy, or he doesn't want, doesn't attribute any importance, he can never attain the status of being a spiritual personality. Already in the Psalms we find, already this discrepancy. When David says, when I take a look, or I see, the heavens thy work, the moon and the stars which you have established. What is man that you should be mindful of? And the man of the earth, the son of the earth, that you take cognizance of. So it means man is a natural being. But just, I mean, he continues, but chasreyu me'at melekim. He's just like God. Just there's a little difference between him and God. And you have surrounded him with majesty and dignity. So in one breath, the psalmist speaks of man, a weak creature, who stands in awe. Who stands actually in awe and is wonderstruck by the works of God, realizing his insignificance and his worthlessness, and he's just Ben Adam, the son of earth, a natural being, like any animal in the forest, but also he is equal to God, and he's surrounded by majesty and dignity. And thus the psalmist expresses the challenge which man encounters, either to lead an absurd existence. It means, as the medieval scholars used to say, an anonymous existence. Because natural existence is anonymous. Or to distinguish himself and equal God. This is the challenge. Around this challenge, then Jewish thought, particularly the halacha, revolves. Man is faced with the challenge. Not a biological challenge. Biological challenge there is. He's non-existent. Biological challenge, all he has to do is just to follow his instinctive drives, in particular the drive for self-preservation and survival. That's all, nothing else. There's no idea. The ideal is to become something else, more than a biological being. But a unique being, equal to God. Man enters into this world as a little brute. However, he may depart from it as a great being. And to this ideal, his life should be dedicated. Or, for instance, I'll give you another quotation. Zaha omrim le ata kidamta le malachi asharet. Lo zaha omrim le yatush kidamcha. Whenever man is worthy of his unique station in the universe, he is congratulated upon his superiority to the angels in heaven. However, when he forfeits his worth, when he doesn't meet the challenge boldly, he is advised that even the mosquito takes precedence over him. But Judaism thought, if man is great, he's greater than the angels. If he's a low being, he's lower than the mosquito. He can rise very high, he can sink very low. The distance is almost endless. There are two opposite poles. And the human life in Judaism swings like a pendulum, oscillates between these two poles, the mosquito and the angel. That man can rise to the heights of angels, you don't need any proof. Just read the history of man, the fact of an Isaiah, of the prophets, would corroborate that. That man can sink to the level of a mosquito, perhaps lower, is enough to quote a few known Nazi types. Goebbels, Himmler, Hitler. This would corroborate, I mean, the Talmudic Midrash thesis. I don't believe we can argue much about this part. However, yes, the image of God, instead of being implanted in man, rises like a mysterious star in the distant heavens and summons man to a heroic effort of reaching out for a world unknown and dimensions undreamed of, in experiencing his choiceness and singularity. According to Judaism, man cannot be filled with pride. If something is being given to him, he could be proud of this possession. Nothing is being given to him. It's only a summons. Man is summoned, to live greatly, magnificently, majestically, and in a dignified manner. But the summons has to be, this, he's summoned into the service of a great cause. But as long as he didn't fulfill his duty, he cannot be proud. It fills man with responsibility and also sense of humility, pride. Because there is a deep assurance. If man is summoned, then he must be assured. Because if he's not assured, the summons is worthless. The Jews knew that any ethical norm given to man, any moral law, any ideal, imposed on him, or any vision opened up to him, must be accompanied by an assurance that he is capable of achieving this ideal, realizing what is expected of him, and simply translating, his dream into action. Otherwise, if there is no assurance, this was the trouble with Christianity. Christianity gave a morality, but did not assure the Christian that he can realize the morality. Morality of one is slapped, he should turn the other cheek to the one who attacked him. Judaism was a realistic religion. Judaism always said, no norm unless the norm is provided with an assurance. Man must be certain, or at least be hopeful of being able to cope with his task, with his problem. That's why Judaism does not, in a manner reminiscent of Christian theology, speak of the fall of man. Christianity speaks of the fall of man. When you speak of fall, already semantically, etymologically, when you say fall, one fell, you presuppose that before he fell, what happened? He was standing on some high plateau and fell down. It means Edom, paradisical man, Edom. It's an archetype of man. It's a symbol of that. Paradisical man, who was before he sinned, before he rebelled against God, as in the story of Genesis, I mean, is told. So he was very high. That's what Christian theologians, dating back to Paul, thought. Very high. He was equal to God. How could Adam be equal to God? He had no opportunity to realize, so to say, the testament which was given to him by God. So apparently, Christian theologians thought that this choiceness of man is a datum. It was given to him. He didn't have to work. He didn't have to realize it. It was given. It's a gift. It's a bestowal of grace upon him. That's why the idea of grace is so prominent in Christian theology. And that's why in Jewish thought, grace does not play such a prominent role. Because Jewish thought wanted man to acquire whatever he is, not just to receive a gift. And the old saying in the Proverbs, V'sone matanot yichye, whoever hates gifts will live long life, applies not only to the relationship between man and man, but also with regard to the relationship between man and God. Don't receive gifts from God. Whatever you receive from him should be well earned. So, of course, the greatest bestowal on man, it means his uniqueness, his personal status, his singularity, should not be just received as a gift, because God in his infinite grace is kind and benevolent to man, but man should earn his way. So Adam had no chance to stand on a high plateau. So that's why we don't speak of fall. There was no fall because he was not distinct yet. He was trying to achieve personality, to attain singularity. The time was too short for him, I mean, to realize this great ideal. This great ideal it's endless. We speak more instead Judaism. When Judaism speaks of the original sin, likes to think of the original sin in terms of man's failure and frustrating experiences. Of a rebellion, which did not cause any fall, but simply frustrated his efforts in his determination to free himself from naturalness and from immediacy and become an autonomous being. The original sin did not result in Adam's fall from his transcendental unique position into an abyss of insensateness, since Adam never reached existential heights. What it resulted, according to Judaism, in Adam's loss of an opportunity to rise to a great existence, in his inability to meet a challenge, to behold a vision, and to stretch out his quivering hand for the almost absurd and impossible. However, the biblical and Greek tradition agree that the task assigned to man is, what is the task, what is the ideal for man, is self-realization. If you ask, what does Judaism require of man? To realize a great ideal, yes, correct. Or to meet the challenge. Or to behold a vision and make a reality out of a dream, of that vision, of a hope. Correct. What is the hope? To be unique. What did God grant him? Nothing but an opportunity. Where is the opportunity? Within himself. What is an opportunity? Potentiality. A healing, that is called by the Aristotelian word, a healing. An opportunity, a challenge. So what is the challenge? Of self-realization. So all Judaism wants of man is to realize himself. Self-fulfillment and self-realization. In this regard, Judaism and classical thought are, I would say, in full agreement. Also, However, ladies and gentlemen, the problem hasn't been resolved yet. The question is, what does self-fulfillment mean? It's a question of defining self. Huh? Then the here we can part company. We perhaps can get company until now, but we may part company and violently disagree and to come to spelling out of what self-fulfillment and self-realization is. But by self-realizing, man actually creates himself in the image of God. So actually what Judaism says, God created just an opportunity for man, but man, in order to be a being who carries the image of God, he must create himself. The image of God is created by man. That's exactly what Judaism insists. And that's why Judaism basically is an articulate, very dynamic, in many respects, an aggressive religion. I mean, in Judaism, such theories as Christian science could have never been, so to say, developed. Because Christian science means whatever man is, he has to be, has to say, experience it in a passive role. Even the question of healing. I mean, he should not intervene in natural processes, should not interfere with God. If God, I mean, so to say, sickness is an expression of a certain disproportionate arrangement within the personality. So, but however, by having faith in Christ or in God, so men can attain, I mean, a cure. I mean, I'm not speaking now from a medical viewpoint about whether this theory makes sense or doesn't make any sense. But from a philosophical viewpoint, it means man is a passive being. All he is on the receiving end, so to say. He receives. He cannot earn anything because he's so corrupt and he's so worthless and he's lazy that he cannot earn his way. He's on the receiving end. It's grace, kindness, benevolence. And the Judaism proclaimed to be rape, and he should heal the sick. Man should heal the sick. So it means no intervene in the works of God. Well, I created you not just as a receiver, as a creature, as a worthless, so to say, creature who is incapable of managing its own affairs, but as a creative being. I want you to be creative, join me in the process of creation, and improve the works of God. Creativity is a great ideal in Judaism, to improve the works of God. God somehow did not finish the world. The universe creation is an unfinished product, not complete, active, not being completed. It is man's job to complete the works of God. To become, as the Talmudic scholars say, shutaf l'kadosh baruch hu b'maaseh breshit, to become a partner of God with regard to the emergence and perfecting of the universe. This is exactly what you're doing. It's an active religion. And of course, the first task before he starts out, I mean, to recreate or change the environment, his first task is to create himself. And creating himself means in the image of God. The image of God is to Judaism not a promise and a norm, a duty, but not a gift. Yeah, as far as this is concerned, the classical and biblical traditions agree. First of all, that man is distinct, and his distinctness is not a factum, but a challenge. And he himself has to bring it about. But I said there is violent disagreement too between them. The classical and biblical traditions also concur in their singling out of the reason as the most powerful instrument of man in his attempt to achieve self-fulfillment and self-realization. All you have to do is just open now my monitors, page 14, and read the last paragraph. My mind has described in the last paragraph deals with the Hebrew word of tzelem. Tzelem means image of God. What does it mean, image of God? Because to the naive person, the word image suggests corporeality of God, or some philosophy of anthropomorphism, that is, if God had a body. That's what my mind tries, to explain, that tzelem is not to be interpreted in anthropomorphic terms, but in spiritual categories. So at the end, I would recommend to you to the reading of this chapter and the second one. As man's distinction consists in a property which no other creature on earth possesses. And what is this property? Nothing else, the intellect. There is intellectual perception, in the exercise of which he does not employ his senses. nor move his hand or his foot. This perception has been compared, though only apparently, not in truth, to the divine perception, which requires no corporeal organ. It means abstract thinking, what it means, not sensuous perception. You see, I mean, the animal, my man, can also see this glass of water, can realize somehow that this is water, by instinctive, so, by instinctive drive. And also, I mean, feel an instinctive drive, I mean, to drink out of this water. But the animal cannot speak, for instance, about the glass of water in abstract terms. This is a body, this body is extended in space. This body, this the water is a liquid, I mean, the glass is solid. I mean the scientific terms cannot formulate its sense experiences in abstract scientific terms. And man was endowed with the ability of formulating his sense experiences in abstract scientific terms. On this account, an account of the divine intellect with which man has been endowed, he is said to have been made in the form and likeness of the Almighty. But far from it be the notion that the Supreme Being is corporeal, having a material form. I mean, this is, I mean, the quintessence of the first chapter. So the first impression is that Maimonides agrees with the Greeks. That why is man distinct? What does his distinctness consist of? In the intellect. I mean, we'll see that Maimonides was wrong in this regard. Completely wrong. I mean, I hate to say it about Maimonides, but they have to be a bit articulate and bold, because if you want to get to the root of Jewish thought, he was wrong because simply he was revolving or moving in the Greek orbit, in the classical orbit. Many times, you know, each generation has its own jargon, philosophical jargon. The Germans used to use the Kantian jargon. The Americans use, I mean, William James or Jewish jargon, certain positivistic jargon. My mind is used the jargon of the Aristotelian Platonic school. And it's hard to free yourself, I mean, from certain cliches or platitudes or some notions and concepts which are popular, it's so popular, I mean, in a certain cultural society, within a certain cultural orbit. But anyway, my mind agrees fully. In singling out the reason as the most powerful instrument of man, And while I wrote out yesterday this lecture, I did not say that Judaism agrees with Greek philosophy, that the reason is this is the element which brings about the singularity of man. I say they agree that reason is the most powerful instrument of man in his attempt to achieve self-fulfillment. This is true. I'll go along with my mind as far as that. That reason is a powerful instrument. Yes, but the question is it only a powerful instrument which serves another end, or reason is the element which brings about man's distinctness? The Greeks will say yes, reason is the element. This is the criterion of distinction. Here is the demarcation line. The brute world of brute creatures has no intellectual capacity, man has intellectual capacity. Here is the demarcation line. Maimonides perhaps will also agree with them. And we'll finally, as we develop our theme, we'll see that Judaism does nothing. Violently, on the other, Judaism rather violently disagrees with this thesis. But however, as to question of instrumentality, Judaism is prepared to accept the Greek thesis that the intellect is a powerful instrument. Man would have never been able to rise to the heights of a meaningful life if he were not endowed with the capacity for and special skill of grasping, comprehending, interpreting himself and his environment. No doubt about that. Greek philosophy is logocentric. Logos is reason to that. Logocentric. What is man logos? What's important for man? To engage intellectual activity. The rational activity was looked upon by the old philosophers of antiquity, I mean, Hellas of Greece, as the worthiest occupation, and very often did the classical thinkers engage in adoration, simply, and worshipping of the intellectual greatness of man, to the point of deification of the intellect. Singing the praise in tones of religious ecstasy and passionate adoration. To Aristotle, it's an ethical problem, you see. If the distinctive element in man is the intellect, so it means what is the highest ideal to be pursued, what is the worthiest occupation, I mean, to engage in thought, what is actually the highest norm, the supreme norm, the highest moral law? I mean, the answer is simple. Since the highest law would command man to realize himself, and what does self-realization mean? Distinctness, uniqueness. And since the distinctive element is reason, so it means the highest norm would tell man, or would say challenge man, to develop his reason. So the theoretical occupation would be considered as the highest form of realization of the ethical norm. The worthiest engagement pursuit is simply to understand. This is what the Greeks say. That's why Aristotle spoke of bios theoreticos, of a theoretical life, the life of the philosophers. This would be, I mean, the ethical consequences of such a metaphysic of man, that man's metaphysic distinctness expresses itself in the intellect. You understand, you know very well, Judaism could not go along to say that the theoretical activity, however important, however great, however powerful in man's advancement, cannot be considered the worthiest activity. If this were the case, if Judaism could subscribe to such a thesis, there would be no need for the prophets to come and to preach to us a different ideal. We could accept Plato and Aristotle and dispense, I mean, with the Bible. The whole Bible revolves about a different kind of norm. Not the intellectual activity. It's an important activity. It's an important engagement. It's very relevant to man. It's a powerful instrument. Everything right, yes. A man should engage in it, but only as a means, not as an end in itself. Here is the big gap which separates the wide, so to say, gulf which separates Judaism from the Greek philosophy. I mean, this is both Halakhic Judaism, Agadic Judaism, Hasidism, any brand of Judaism. If asked, what is the highest, so to say, norm in man's life? What is the most precious, cherished principle, ethical principle? What is the moral law? Or using a Kantian expression, the categorical imperative? We would not answer like Aristotle, intellectual activity. We would give another answer, but this answer I wouldn't tell you. I wouldn't betray now because I'll be out of a job, I mean. This is a problem which we'll have to, I mean, to explore. The Jewish tradition has also paid tribute to the rational nature of man, no doubt. When God asked Solomon, let us see, I made a statement, and any statement should be proven. Don't take statements on your face value. Always ask for proof. If people speak about Judaism, this is a trouble. If a rabbi comes and speaks about Judaism, people, laymen, I mean, take your statements for granted. I mean, never believe, never have any confidence in a rabbi. Because Judaism, it's a very, very, it's very big, our philosophy is big, and we have to check and recheck, I mean, like a science laboratory, whether what we say and we want to formulate is correct, or it's just a figment of our imagination. So now we said, so Judaism would not consider intellectual activity as the highest form of human engagement, yes. However, what intellectual activity is very important in Judaism. It's a powerful instrument, but an instrument leading to the realization of a different goal. Correct, yes, yes. Now let me prove that Judaism in general thought that intellectual activity is a very important activity, although not placing it on the highest level and not making out of the intellectual norm the highest moral law. For instance, when God asks Solomon in the Bible, when God asks Solomon, do you have a Bible here or no?
Yeah.
Will you give me the English text? Oh, it's a hard job to find this. All right, Eli. Second son of Malachi, First Kings.
Yes. 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 Would you, with First Kings, just a moment, page 406. If someone has a Bible, page 406, First Kings. Yes. And the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, ask what I shall give thee. And Solomon said, and now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people, that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give thy servant, therefore, an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this, thy great people? So what did Solomon ask? For knowledge, for understanding, for a discriminating judgment, for intellectual excellence, how to judge, how to guide, how to govern his people. A discerning and discriminating judgment can be asked for theoretical purposes by the scientist and also for practical political purposes by the politician and king and ruler. And the Bible tells us, and the speech pleased the Lord, that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said unto him, because thou hast asked this thing, and hast not asked for thyself long life, neither hast asked riches for thyself, nor hast asked the life of thine enemies, but hast asked for thyself understanding to discern justice, behold, I have done according to thy word. I have given thee a wise and understanding heart, so that there hath been none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee. The old saying that Solomon was the wisest among men. It's already, apparently the intellectual excellence is a very important prophet. Otherwise, Solomon wouldn't have asked for that, and God wouldn't have sanctioned his request as a very wise choice. Now, it's very interesting that this is perhaps the reason for the preference given to the petition for understanding, knowledge and wisdom within the silent prayer of the 18 blessings, what we call Shemona Esrei. The silent prayer of the Shemona Esrei, it's not 18, actually, it's 19 blessings now, but the original prayer had 18, that's why you call it Shemona Esrei. The silent prayer is divided into three parts. The first part is the introductory blessings, which deal simply with introducing men to God. Man introduces God, himself to God and adores God. This great, powerful, particularly merciful, full of mercy. Then the middle part is concerned with the petitional prayers or intercessory prayers, what you call them. It means we simply ask God he should gratify our basic needs. For instance, we ask him he should forgive our sins. He should heal the sick. He should bless mankind with economic prosperity. Then we have the national, prayers, ingathering of the exiles, the rebuild, restoration of Zion, and so forth. But interesting is that the first prayer, the middle part of the petitionary, of the prayers or intercessory prayers, begins at the Honin Ladam Dat. You have bestowed knowledge and intellect upon men. Umlamed Lenish, you teach us men how to understand. And you ask God, Honenu Mitcha Deya Bina Vyasin. Just grant us understanding, discrimination, and good judgment. And you conclude the prayer Baruch atah Hashem, Chanin Hadat. Blessed be thou who bestows upon man knowledge and wisdom. The first prayer. This is very indicative. It's perhaps more indicative than the passage of the Bible already. But the prayers were very carefully formulated and cautiously chosen. And with this petition, the petition for understanding, not for the absolution of sins, not for a pure heart, not for economic prosperity, not for health, and not for national revival or redemption, but for knowledge, opens up, so to say, the middle part, opens the middle part of intercessory prayers, indicates that man has no right to ask for anything unless he's assured of knowledge and wisdom. The supplication dealing with man's urgent need for knowledge ushers the worshipper into the silent prayer. Apparently, one must not address any petition to God unless he was assured that the most basic need is going to be gratified, and the basic need is the one for knowledge. This is correct. However, up to here, Judaism would, so to say, walk hand in hand, arm in arm. I would say Isaiah would walk arm in arm with Plato and Socrates. They've never met. The legend is that Plato has met when he was in Egypt. He met a disciple of Jeremiah, Baruch ben Neria, son of Neria. It's a bit anachronistic, I mean, but I am inclined to believe, and I'm not a chauvinist, I want you to know. I don't believe that we gave the world everything the world has. We didn't give the world mathematics, nor did we give physics to the world. It's ridiculous. Some rabbis begin to simply become almost ecstatic about speaking the contributions that Jewish people made to the general culture. It's not true. We made great contributions, but in certain fields. Of course, our contribution is in the field of religion and ethics, no doubt about that. And I firmly believe, that Plato, while he was in Egypt, met some Jews of the Babylonian, so-called exiles from Zion, or immigrants from Palestine, still at the first Commonwealth, and he certainly had long conversations with them. And he certainly learned a lot from them. And many passages in Plato, which somehow suggest to us that Jeremiah or Isaiah or any prophet knew each other and discussed the topics because they give identical answers, were influenced by prophetic thought. Of course, you know, in the 11th letter, Plato says that I was in Egypt and I learned from all Oriental scholars whatever I could learn. He himself, concedes that he owes a debt of gratitude to Oriental wisdom. And of course, Egypt at that time abounded in Jewish scholarship and wisdom. The communication between Palestine and Egypt, the communication of ideas and thoughts and actual exchange of information and simply, in terms of travel, was so alive that there's no doubt that he met Jewish scholars. Of course, German scholars, because of anti-Semitic inclinations, declared this letter to be not genuine, but a forgery. They could not tolerate the thought that the Aryan Plato has learned something from Semites. As they did with regard to the Bible. They said the Bible, on the contrary, we owe a debt to Babylonia or Assyria or anybody else, for the basic ideas of the Bible. But anyway, there is no doubt that there is some common element between the prophets and Platonic thought. There is no doubt about it. But up to here, they disagree. Man is distinct, distinctness is a challenge, and the reason is a powerful instrument. That's it. Now let's see. Judaism, if I may say so, placed itself in opposition to the classical theory of man, mainly with regard to two basic issues. Well, let us see. First, with respect to the problem, it's important. Although, it's not the central problem, but it's important in order to get a better understanding of Jewish philosophy of man. with respect to the problem of men versus mankind, men versus community, or men versus society, the two disparate, incommensurable approaches, the Greeks and the Jews. Second, relative to our problem, to the problem of logocentricity, whether men must be logocentric or it should revolve about a higher ideal than the intellectual excellence. Let me explain these two issues. I'll start with a side issue, but this side issue, the question of men versus community, men versus society, men facing men as representative of mankind, or individual man representing universal man, but this will cast a light upon the Jewish approach to man, even with regard to the problem of intellectual activity. When the Greeks philosophized about the fate and destiny of men, they always thought in terms of universality. In other words, what aroused their curiosity and inquisitiveness was not single men, no. Not lonely men, not men for himself, not the individual, no. Somehow the Greeks never saw the individual. It's strange. But men as a spokesman for his class, for his species, or they call this the genus, genus, G-E-N-U-S. Or mankind, when they speak of men, it is not men. It's always the collective, mankind. Basically the Greeks, after all, democracy, it's very funny, we can't understand it. Democracy was developed among Greeks. And Greeks, in their approach to man, adopted the philosophy of the corporate state. No individual man, no man for himself, no longer, they didn't see him single. But man, when they said man, you can't speak of mankind, so if they speak of man, but man as a representative of mankind or of society. Men always, when they spoke of man, is not the particular man. But man anonymous means man, any man. The archetype, nothing to do with the archetypes in Jung, archetype. The symbol, the idea, or what they call it, the morphe, the form. Form was an idea, an ideal. Fascinated the minds of old Greece, old Hellas. Socrates and Plato, since Socrates and Plato, they kept on asking one question. Not what is concrete man. Somehow the abstract philosophers, Greek philosophers, did not ask what is concrete man. Never mind what man should be. What is it? But what are the conceptual morphological patterns of man in abstract? Of man in general, of the universal type, the representative of mankind. They never somehow saw the individual, the lonely person, who did not integrate himself into and refused to serve the crowd somehow. They never saw man who leads not a standardized and fixed, but a non-conforming and strange life. When they spoke of men, it's men conforming.
Men standardized. Men whose life is fixed. Rigid, whose life is rigid. Rigid, of course, fashioned after certain general patterns. In a word, they overlooked the individual. There's no right to be. Per se, any person. Only when the individual life is dovetailed with the concern and pursuits of universal man, it may find meaning and only that mean existential worth. Only that. If he is a servant of mankind, cannot serve himself. The individual existence is the medium through which the species, or the genus, or the class, asserts itself. Of course, listen to the problem of procreation. If the species wants to survive, I mean, it cannot survive by itself as an abstract entity. It has to use and employ the individuals as instruments, as tools, which makes survival and self-preservation possible. Otherwise, it's impossible. So, of course, all man has to do is to make himself available to the universal man. All lowly man has to do. To mankind and place himself at the disposal of the rockets. Procreation, for instance, through which the class or the species perpetuates itself, is only possible if the individual is ready to accept the universal commitment and to look upon himself as the instrument of some higher ontic order. And what is the higher order than the individual? Mankind, or man in abstract, the concept. I'll call it even if you may introduce this nice name, it doesn't say, I think, humanity. Although humanity, we distinguish humanity and mankind, but to me it doesn't say much. It depends how the individual man is living. If the individual is incapable or unwilling to conform with the interests of society, either or, incapable of or unwilling to conform the interests of society, he forfeits his legitimate claims to existence. You know very well that in Sparta, of course, Sparta is not characteristic of Greece, but still it's a part of that community. The Greek people, they used to kill retarded and sick children. This is very indicative. Even of later, of course, very primitive. And later, you wouldn't find it in the Greek literature, or even particularly the conservative literature, but this approach governs Greek thought from Thales down to the Stoic. Now, in a word, the Greek philosophy wanted men to live, act, and create, not along individual patterns, but along universal patterns. And in compliance with the rigid standards which universal man has discovered and set up for him to follow. It came to almost an absurd expression in the Roman positive law system. You know what law meant to the Roman? Something is unchangeable, unalterable, something fixed and rigid, and that's all. What is the law? The positive Roman law is nothing else but the will of not an individual man, but man universal man, man as such. Otherwise, the individual exists rightfully only then when he enjoys the grace of a higher universal form of existence, when universal man bestows upon him kindness and benevolence. Otherwise, he will end up its workings, frustrations, and complete existential failure. This was the great theory. And what is interesting is not so much the idea as the similes they used to illustrate this. Many picturesque similes were employed to illustrate this philosophy. This philosophy of, I would say, class absolutism, or society absolutism, or the absolutism of the universe. For instance, one symbol was the tree bursts forth into blossoms in the spring and sheds his foliage in the autumn. Who is concerned with the individual leaf? Who is concerned with the leaf tossed by the storm in a dark autumn night, which lives as long as it was nourished by the sap of the tree? As soon as the supply was discontinued, it withered and died and fell off the tree. Who is concerned? Or they used to introduce another simile, the mighty ocean, which contains an almost infinite number of water particles. Who would care about a single drop of water within this endless reservoir? The fate of the lonely leaf, tossed by the storm in the autumn, while the tree from which it fell is accumulating food for next spring. then it will burst forth into new processes. And the fate of the isolated drop of water absorbed by the sand on the beach, while the roar of the onrushing tide of the ocean manifests itself in force and might, is very typical of the destiny of the individual who detached himself from society, from mankind. Who cares about the single leaf? Who cares about the single drop of water? Who cares about the single individual? Interesting is how this philosophy somehow slipped in into religion. I wouldn't say Jewish religion, it was a sect. Among Jews who seem to adopt this philosophy. You see, this philosophy, I'll show you later, has tremendous ethical complications in terms of social services. But now we are not speaking about the, so to say, the you want to ask me a question? Yes, sir. It's a very hard question. Basically, the Greeks knew of democracy, but they knew nothing about the dignity of the individual. You see, our brand of democracy, the American brand, which is based on the lex naturae, developed, I mean, of course, not developed, but developed by the Stoics, but later, of course, I mean, formulated and reinterpreted by the English positivistic philosophers and by the French, by the Age of Reason, by the philosophy of Age of Reason, based democracy upon dignity of the individual. Actually, the declaration of independence, I mean, combines democracy with the inherent rights, not in mankind, but in the individual. The Greeks, you know, I'll show you, this is a Jewish concept. The Greeks somehow, it is a marvel, actually. It's a problem. They knew of political democracy, or rule of the crowd, so it was not democracy in sense, because demos, the crowd, the rule of the crowd, you see. You see, it isn't, basically, democracy is not the proper word to describe a form of government which should serve the individual, yes? But democracy means rule of the crowd. So it's the crowd more than the individual. And the contrary, since the king is individual, that's how the mind works in the opposite direction. Since the king is only individual, what right does he have, I mean, to determine, I mean, the fate and destiny of many, of the crowd, of mankind, of society? So they say democracy means the rule of the crowd, but not individual. The crowd does not serve the individual. The crowd serves itself. Its own interest. I mean, sometimes the idea is, in our mind, is identified with basic principles, and actually if we pursue, I mean, the development of the idea, we see that our categories are not applicable, I mean, in when we want to approach, I mean, the origins, I mean, the biography of this. Now, interesting is that the religious philosophers somehow, in the Middle Ages, revolved in the classical orbit, arrived at a very clear conclusion. Respective divine providence, but the kolashgach, divine providence. They maintain that God is concerned only with the destiny of men in general, however, is completely indifferent to the individual as anonymous, as an autonomous entity. The latter is not under the management, government, and rule of God. He and his destiny was abandoned and left unexposed to mechanical insensate forces, to change and vicissitudes, and to chance and coincidence. That's all. I take sleep, not God can sleep. I should pray to God when I'm sick? No. Prayers only can be addressed to God if they deal with the good of the community or the good of mankind. If who are you, I mean, to address yourself to God? You are worthless. You are simply, your existence is irrelevant. It's not even a legitimate existence. It's somehow my existence, if I don't serve society, is stolen. And I'm a receiver of stolen goods somehow. Only insofar as the single person contributes toward the preservation and advancement of the species, the former is under divine rule and guidance. I'll ask you to open now the the guide, my mind is knows of this theory, he fought against. It is third section, the guide is divided into three sections, and it is chapter, just a moment, it was on the third section, chapter 17th chapter. Just a minute. Third section. Yes, chapter 17, and it means page 282. Yes, I would ask you to read this chapter to you, because here you find, I mean, a reflection of Greek thinking and a reflection of Jewish opposition to Greek thinking. Actually, Maimonides encountered this problem, in spite of the fact that he was so devoted to Aristotle. And he thought Aristotle actually has achieved the greatest heights in philosophy and science, but still only parts company with Aristotle, as a Jew he could not accept. Now, yes, there are four different theories at the beginning of the chapter. There are four different theories concerning divine providence. They are all ancient, known since the time of the prophets, when the true law was revealed to enlighten these dark regions. So you already tries to contrast the prophets with Aristotle. You see. Now, I mean, I cannot read everything. The third, just a moment. Yeah. Just a moment. Excuse me, just a little one part. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. The second theory, whilst one part of the universe owes its existence to providence and is under the control of a ruler and governor, another part is abandoned and left to chance. What part is under the rule of God and what part is abandoned and left to chance? You understand? The universal, so to say, patterns in being, the kind, the classes, the genera, the species, mankind, and also the animal, the classes of, the species, the various species of animals, are also under divine guidance and rule. Man has no unique station. He's only as important as a representative of his species, not important as individual. This is the view of Aristotle about providence. Of course, when Aristotle spoke of providence, he didn't mean it in theological terms. The Aristotelian concept of providence is something different, but Maimonides somehow introduced the later Arabic philosophers, to read in to Aristotle, theological thoughts. And I will now explain to you this theory. Evolved that God controls the spheres, of course, the heavens have a separate status, and what they contain. Therefore, the individual beings in the spheres remain permanently in the same form. It means the angels, so to say, the spiritual beings. Spiritual beings are important. But however, it goes on. You'll take 283, I'll ask you to read it. But all other movements, however, which are made by the individual members of each species, are due to accidents. They are not, according to Aristotle, the result of rule and management. When a storm and a gale blows, it causes undoubtedly some leaves of the tree to drop. You see again the symbol of the leaf. It's a similar leaf which repeated itself throughout in the antiquity and the Middle Ages. It breaks off some branches of another tree, tears away a stone from a heap of stones, raises dust over herbs, and spoils them, and stirs up the sea so that the ship goes down with a whole part of her contents. Aristotle sees no difference between the falling of a leaf is very important, as Maimonides says, and he formulated it wonderfully. Between the falling of a leaf of a stone and the death of the good and noble people on the ship. Significant event. Whether a stone falls down or a leaf is torn up the tree, or a great man, an individual dies on a ship which capsized. Nor does it distinguish between the destruction of a multitude of ends caused by an axe deposited on them with excrement, and the death of worshippers killed by the fall of the house when its foundations give way. There's no difference if 90 children are killed in a fire in Chicago, or a heap of ants killed by the because the Naxalim actually stepped on this hill, on this pile. Nor does it discriminate between the case of a cat killing a mouse that happens to come in her way, or that of a spider catching a fly, and that of a hungry lion meeting a prophet in turn. Beautifully informed. And this exactly, you see what I said, I mean, it's correct. Please read this chapter, pull the whole chapter. Of course, this disdainful attitude, the Greeks adopted with regard to the individual is in keeping with their ontology and with their philosophy of being in general. Let us remember that a classical mind approach to reality, I'll just give you a short survey of the background, under a dual aspect, namely, there is in life or in existence contingency and necessity. That's what I said. There is something accidental and something what is lawful. There is chaos and order. The Greek didn't believe that everything is arranged in an orderly fashion. The universe as such is heterogeneous, consisting of unorganized, individual, incidental matter, eluding the grasp of the intellect, since it is basically non-intelligible, and this which is individual, Plato had a good word for that. For the individual, he called meon. Whoever knows that in Greek meon means half being, semi being, not a full being, not important. Meon, nothing. For the kind is in Plato ontoson. Being, it's funny, you should take being both as an adjective and as a noun. It's hard to translate in the other language. Ontoson, it is to be, I say that's to be. But the individual is meon. On means being. Meon means have being, someone, a shadow. He spoke of shadows. You know the story, the scene about the cave in the Republic. I mean, it's just that mankind casts a shadow. And who is the shadow of mankind? The individual. So who cares if this shadow disappears? Another shadow will come. This exact. If this is true about the entire order of events, it's also relevant, the Greek thought, as regards men. The individual is just incidental, transient, ephemeral, a passing event, or a whim. It's a whim. It's a caprice. Whim through which the class or mankind activates and maintains itself. What if not this wing, some other wing will come along. If a single person understands his task and position in the universe and makes an effort to fulfill his mission to which he is committed as a representative of mankind, it means to serve mankind, he exists his existence is a legitimate one. It means he's still male on. A shadow, half being, but it's a legitimate neon. It can never become ontoson. Ontoson is a title which is compared only on mankind, not on mankind, on any species, on the general order, not on individual order. If he fails to realize this particular role assigned to him by nature, he simply loses his antique license. I mean, the license to exist, the right to live and to exist. I mean, of course, I present it in very brutal terms, but more or less, whoever acquainted with Greek philosophy and the spirit know that it's true inside my mind. Now, the implications of this theory of class absolutism are enormous. I'm speaking of practical implications in terms of social philosophy and social science. Are enormous. And I'm coming to it because I don't believe this theory is completely passive. There is a bit of this theory which somehow is implanted in each one of us, and particularly in certain social systems, it is perhaps the center of social activity and social self. That's why I'm taking it up. I'm a little departing from this philosophical analysis. The implications of this theory of class absolutism are enormous if we try to translate this doctrine in terms and categories of social philosophy and service. I mean, in order, I want to picture, a social service which will be fashioned after this philosophy of man in order to understand what Judaism had accomplished. You know, always, colors are only identified by contrast. And if not by contrast, if there is no contrast, you cannot appreciate anything. And that's this method of contrasting Judaism with Hellenistic thought, which was very abstract and very fine philosophy, in order to emphasize what Judaism has accomplished for modern man. Not missing too many words and not wasting them in phrases, we may state in terse terms that according to the classical tradition, the worth of the individual is measured by his usefulness to society. That's all. That's dispensing, you know, this metaphysical phraseology. See? An individual is worth of individual, the dignity, is measured by his usefulness to society. We should not ask, the question actually we should not ask, what is man for himself? It's a foolish question to the degree. Who cares about him? What is intrinsic worth, is inherent valuableness? Simple, it's an absurd question, doesn't serve it. But what can man do as a representative of mankind? How can he serve best his class, the species? How can the shadow, the neon, serve best the ontoson, the true being? Some exalted God was enthroned by the Greeks, and this exalted God was mankind. And you'll see this reflection in philosophies of corporate states. Because it's differently formulated, differently sort of say worded, but it's the same idea. His ontogeny, existential station, is determined by his accomplishments for the good of the class. The external activity, the arrogant, dynamic hands. Under hands, I understand, I mean, his external activity. And the man, arrogant man, who can step out of himself and engage in external activity, I mean, and not his modest, but fine-tuning soul, the hidden inner life, determine the worth of person. His hand, that is. His intellect is also, the intellect is capable of achievements, not the heart. What he accomplishes, not what he is. The man who is active, not the man who has been frustrated, for no fault of his. Axiologically, man is measured by his work. It's an equation, like a mathematical equation. Man equals the amount of work, or the number of attainments, accomplishments he can deliver to society. Of course, you'll ask me, I'll refer to your question again, what's about equality? After all, democracy, all I'd like to be the rule of the crowd, but democracy is based upon the ideal of égalité, of equality. It's a basic category in our political and social thinking. Yeah, and then also was a basic category in the Greek thinking, égalité. But the French Revolution did not accomplish much by espousing the cause of égalité. It was known to the Greeks, before that. But however, when we speak about equality, we have to distinguish between three kinds of equality. And here we make a big mistake. Yet when we speak of equality, we must distinguish between three different forms of the basic democratic principle, of this basic democratic principle. First of all, political equality. It means, in other words, it's equality before the law, and also, the state or society or community affords equal opportunity and protection to everyone. Correct? That's all. It's equality. Political equality means equality of opportunity. It's not only the equality of walking into the election booth and cast my ballot. This is just one of the expressions of equality of opportunity. It means equal opportunity. Democratic education, public school system, so forth. Second, economic equality. Of course, the equal sharing in the goods which man produces. This is socialism. Socialism also considers itself a democracy. They speak of the people's democracy. And they always say that while the Western democracies are committed to political equality, they are committed not to political, but to economic. Of course, they say that committed to political quality as a what? All right, if you want to believe it.
Third.
And this is this type of equality which Greek didn't know, I don't believe anybody knows. Axiological equality. What does it mean, axiological? That means equality as to worth of man, as to valuableness of man. Axiological means equality as to value. The attribution of equal worth and value to all individuals, notwithstanding the fact that their contributions to the well-being, the welfare of the community or society may widely differ. It's a great idea. Please do it. How can you treat on par the Aristotle, Mr. Schulich? How can you treat on par Socrates, who is a slave? After all, I mean, Greek was a slave economy. It was based on a slave economy. The barbarian and the Hellenic type. A Greek couldn't, the best minds among them couldn't imagine this type of equality. That it is quite paradoxical that in societies, and we'll take our own society, the Western society, whose form of government is democratic, the individual is not treated socially in conformity with the inner worth and dignity bestowed upon him by the Creator at the hour of creation, but according to his usefulness in society. Willingly, you must admit that. In our approach to man, I cannot help myself. When I'll speak to the President of the United States, I'll be mental disposition will be different one than when I address myself to the grocery board. I mean, why? It's a question I measure, apparently. Let's be very, very frank about ourselves. Because apparently we not revealed, but at least, I mean, the President of the United States commands our respect. It was revealed. It works for $8 a day or $10 a day. Does not command our respect. We are not disturbed, we are not so very excited, but we'll be quite excited if we have an appointment with the President of the United States. What does it mean? In ethical terms, means that we attribute more worth because of the office or because of the personality of the President of the United States. I don't care about this. It depends upon the kind of a president one is. Yes, but we attribute more worth, greater value, to the president, or to the great scientist, the great engineer, the great surgeon, or anybody who is prominent in society, who contributed to something towards the well-being and advancement of society at any level, scientific level, economic level, the great manufacturer. But when you speak to an ordinary person or to a beggar on the street, we wouldn't treat him apart. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. I mean, hypocrisy is something which Judaism hated the most. So it means axiologically we differentiate between people. Do we know the intrinsic worth of the President of the United States or of the grocery boy? Perhaps the grocery boy has to soul movements and steerings, and very tender steerings within his, so to say, awareness. A fine-feeling heart is by far superior to the President of the United States. Apparently we don't compare. I mean, the intrinsic worth of the grocery boy with that of the President of the United States, but our comparison is at the level of one's usefulness. Of course, the President is more useful than the grocery boy. Sometimes we think that the President is almost indispensable. People used to think about Roosevelt like that. All right, and even if the President is dispensable and quite replaceable, we attribute to him a greater measure of usefulness than to the grocery boy or to the servant. Is this axiological democracy? No. Let's be honest with ourselves. Under no circumstances, ladies and gentlemen. It means this ideal we have never achieved. And basically, that's what the Greeks preached. There is no axiological democracy because individual himself is nothing. You consider him only in the light of his service to society, to mankind. And of course, If the determining factor is service, so whoever gives more service is worthier than the one who gives less service. Now,
In countries, of course, I'm speaking now about Western society, in countries where socialist attempts at economic equalization of men are made, the communist society, of course the individual had been stripped completely of his inward significance and relevance and turned into a servant of the community, not an automaton who is judged by his productive capacity. I don't have to tell it to you that about Russia. What is perhaps new is that we ourselves are sinners in this regard. And instinctively, we react in a different manner when we meet a prominent person or when we meet an ordinary person. As I said before, the practical consequences in terms of social service are almost staggering. Let us imagine a social service fashioned after this idea, after the ideal of meon and ontoson, man servant of society, man half shadow, half being, servant of the true being. Now let me spell out it in brutal terms, a little ruthless terms, in absurd terms, but nevertheless, the terms will reflect, the very essence of a social service fashioned after such a philosophy of man. Social service basically, as I understand social service, basically denotes a moral relationship, between the society and the individual. This is my own definition of a layman. Please don't criticize me. Have a little sympathy with me and suffer my mistakes and my ignorance. Social service basically denotes a moral relationship between society and the individual. And it commits the former, that means society, to help the person who is incapable for a variety of reasons, sometimes culpable reasons, not only when the person is innocent, but sometimes when he's basically, he involved himself in a situation which he cannot extricate himself for a variety of reasons to take care of himself. If he is incapable of taking care of himself, society comes to his help. And this is what I understand on a social. Is it correct or wrong? I'll ask your opinion. More or less. All right, that's all. Such a description of the role of social service would hardly fit into the classical philosophy of class absolutism. Absolutely not. The society owes the individual nothing. I mean a moral relationship. If there's a moral relationship between society and individual, it means society is committed. It's a commitment. So it means ontoson, let us say in there, because it's a very funny expression, ontoson, true being, legitimate being, is committed what? To meon, to shadow? Am I committed to my shadow? I'm not committed to my shadow. It's ridiculous to say. Nothing. The latter's task, on the contrary, the latter's task is to serve the welfare and good of the class. His existence is just incidental, devoid of meaning and relevance. As long as he does not place himself at the disposal of the group, his worth is proportionate to his work for the latter. If he becomes incapacitated and unable to serve, then his life is worthless. Who is supposed to help him? Actually, if we are very consistent, so there is no social service within such a society. Why should society care for him? As a matter of fact, and I want to say, the classical society knew nothing of social service. In general, they did not grasp the idea of charity, tzedakah, or loving kindness, etc. Neither Plato nor Aristotle nor the Stoics, it's interesting, in order to appreciate what Judaism had accomplished, nor the Stoics have included these virtues among the desirable qualities of a moral personality. They always spoke, when they spoke of the moral qualities, they spoke of justice, moderation, courage, orderliness, but never of goodness, never of long suffering, never of tzedakah. However, yet, if we should try cautiously to formulate a theory of social service which would fit into the classical anthropological framework of the ontoson and meon, we could begin with the laying down of two premises. First, society owes nothing, of course, to the individual. There is no moral relationship between society and individual, but there is a relationship, instead of moral, a pragmatic one, a utilitarian relationship. Yes? Yeah. Society, in order to protect its own interests, is duty-bound for sheer pragmatic reasons, not morally, for sheer pragmatic reasons, to assist those individuals who, in spite of their temporary helplessness, can still be considered as potentially useful members of society and capable of hearty, productive participation in the universal endeavor. Of course, man takes sick, he's poor, but he serves society well. Society will take care of him for one reason only, because when he'll recover after his convalescence, he'll serve society again. It's not a moral relationship. It's a pragmatic insight. Secondly, we can stretch our imagination a bit more and say society, in a spirit of magnanimity and gratitude to its members who rendered an important service to the group, extends help and condolence and consolation to them, even though their productive role was terminated for good, since they have made a substantial contribution toward the advancement of public welfare. We can say that the Greek may become very moral and also feel, so to say, qualms of conscience as far as gratitude is concerned. All right, for instance, if Socrates became old, he died young because they killed him. But Socrates were old, so the Greek would put him in a home for the aged. Why? Who's supposed to care about Socrates? He published his books, all you have to say. But there's a sense of gratitude. Basically, it would be a pragmatic relationship. Society supports the individual as long as the individual is useful to it. However, if we should introduce a moral aspect, we'll say yes, out of gratitude. Yes. It is, of course, self-evident that society feels by far more obligated with respect to the first class, the potential, to its potentially valuable members, than to the second one, to the has-beens, of course. However, great their accomplishments were, that utilitarian motive holds sway over debt of appreciation and thankfulness, as always. Now, what will happen? Let us see what kind of a social service could be developed along these lines, which is basically, opposed to the Jewish ideal of social service. Let us examine a few hypothetical cases. Useful members of society, of course, deserve better care than the average person, no doubt about it. If, for instance, an engineer working on an important technological project, let us say complying with the popular sentiment on a missile project, to send a missile not only to the moon, but to the sun or to some fixed star. All right. Okay. Is entitled to more expert medical care than a shoemaker or a taxi driver. Let us not forget. If they both took sick, suddenly, an emergency operation were required, necessary, while there were only one surgeon, of course the engineer would have priority over the anonymous Mr. X. Is it only a hypothetical case, or actually do you act like that? I wouldn't say in such radical instances, but I'm afraid you are giving. It's funny, when President Eisenhower took sick, so they brought him in Paul White from Boston. So many experts for this. Yeah, but when a person enters a ward in a hospital, the resident physician or even the intern is good enough for him. Sometimes, certain things we practice, if we try to formulate them, they appear very awkward. And very queer, that's exactly what we are doing. Country, I and everybody else. The concern, for instance, something else would be, this is already a problem. For instance, the concern of society for child welfare would be treated as of a higher social service order than the caring for the aged.
are both helpless. The child is helpless, the aged person is helpless. What Judaism said about it, I don't know yet. As far as this is concerned, you understand what the attitude of Isaiah would be, an engineer and a shoemaker. Take sick, an operation has to be performed, and the prominent person is given precedence, is given priority. You understand how Isaiah would express himself about it. But this problem is a problem in Judaism too. But we are not now trying to describe the Jewish approach. We are still describing the classical approach to social service. Child care is superior to the care for the aged. For a simple reason. Of course, in a society which is dedicated to pragmatic interests, the individual as such per se does not play any role, but the individual is always judged in the light of his usefulness to society. Of course, the child is a potential useful member of tomorrow, and the old man was a valuable servant of yesteryear. Of course, a valuable servant of tomorrow and a valuable servant of yesterday, I mean, the question requires no attention at all.
I say here, I leave the question mark, what the Jewish attitude can be. What is allocation of funds? And this and that. It's a question. Because we cannot just dismiss this. Now, for instance, furthermore, we would discriminate between the gifted and the mediocre and dull children. And we would display a deeper sense of sympathy and understanding for the forest, while we would not be so much preoccupied with the second type, with the dull child. As to care needed for the retarded or problem children, society would not feel obligated at all. As a matter of fact, Sparta used to kill. Germany began to practice. He hit Hitler at no time, simply it was. He simply was put out of business, I mean, quickly. I mean, there wasn't use, instead of having homes for the aged to kill them off, people are living. Of course, what can the group expect in form of service from an adult who will be burdened with a 7-year-old mentality? As far as education is concerned, of course, society would offer the child not what is best for the child, but what would serve best its general interest. It would deny the boy or the girl an education which would realize certain, which would satisfy an inner need in the boy and the girl. For instance, the boy and girl are musically inclined. Would not educate them, I mean, in music, train them as musicians, because they also have good skills. And as an engineer, they can serve society better than a musician, and the capacity of a musician. It is done and practiced in Russia, you know. The dull child, they not deal with the retarded child. I don't know what to do with the retarded child. But the dull child or the even the average child has no opportunity. After completing his primary grades, he sent off the factory. Who wants to give the child, particularly who has a slant for math, a technological slant, is offered unlimited opportunity. And this is not just arbitrary, we say it's ruthless, it's cruel. It's not cruel, it fits into a beautiful philosophical framework. Society would not treat all aged people equally, you know? It would build rest homes and retreats for those who distinguish themselves in their service, distinguish themselves with regard to society, and would disdainfully refuse to help the ones who did not merit the gratitude of society. Take in Russia. I read always a home for aged literati, for writers, for engineers, for doctors. I don't know. Do we have such homes in America? I doubt it. Why only for doctors? Why only for engineers? Why for writers? Why not for the average aged person? Society doesn't owe anything to the average aged person because he's worthless. There is no intrinsic worth. As a servant of mankind, he is only a male on. If he makes himself valuable to the hunters on, he's all right. the writer made himself barren. The scale of salary is again. That such a concept of social service is possible, and also it can be practiced, and such standards may be set up for the formulation of practical policies, can be proven by observing many practices in our Western society. We are not perfect, we are far from it. And of course, and the general institutions of social service in the communist countries. And here Judaism comes in. All right, this will be next time.